to my mind, technology is the greatest threat to real estate today. So for example, right now people have to live in urban or suburban centers, right? And you can only build in certain places because of the limitations of what we can build. What if I told you though, that you could build a house wherever you wanted, you'd pay for it brand new at less than 2/3 of the cost of a used house, and you can build it custom to whatever you wanted, and it would be ready to go in 6 weeks.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for the day, David Prail. David, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Really excited to hear your story. So everyone, David is in real estate, finance, and a technology enthusiast who has a platform to help people of all wealth levels build a diversified real estate portfolio, which is a really awesome goal and something that I'm passionate to. Me, my tagline is closing the investing gap one investor at a time. So very excited to hear about that. Why don't you start us off, David, with how you got into, you know, the investing space, the real estate space, and what your big why was?
Yeah. So this goes back to what some of us like to call the aha moment. And I distinctly remember where I was even standing when this hit me. It was in a hallway in my college. And it hit me that they're just, like, here we're in college, we're training for jobs. And the people who are out there making a lot of money, they're not really working. They're just, their money's just throwing off money for them. And that kind of started me on this very long journey of learning about the world of investing. And I started in the stock market, moved into options, tried different things. And eventually when I wanted to bring opportunities to smaller investors, the stuff I was doing in the stock market wasn't appropriate for them. I kind of settled in on real estate, and I tried doing something. I'm based in Israel, as we discussed, but the market here doesn't really allow for the types of returns you'd want to see. So I naturally gravitated back towards the U.S., where we're born and bred in New Jersey and lived 10 years in New York. A lot of connections in the real estate world there, and seeing the returns that were available, seeing the risk reward setups that were being offered across all different asset classes, it just made a lot of sense. Another reason why, specifically real estate, early on in my investment journey, I read one of the lessons that I learned that was very impactful, especially around the 2008 time when the world was imploding, was you always have to understand when you're investing, you have to understand where the value is coming from. Where's your money being generated from? So, you know, if you're buying a company like Apple, so you know your profits are being generated by the sale of phones and computers and some services. If you're buying into some sort of major conglomerate, you don't really know. It could be complicated. You don't know where it's coming from. 2008, the entire world collapsed because people were trading derivatives and no one understood where the underlying value was. And that's how things became so inflated. So what's nice about real estate is you don't have to be that sophisticated to understand where the value is coming from. You own a property, they're tenants, they pay rent. Obviously, you have to know how to run a property if you want to buy one. The devil's in the details, but the basic value proposition is there and open for anybody. So that's where the direction we went in, and that's what we've been doing.
Awesome. Yeah, great story. And I just, you mentioned something kind of briefly, and if you wouldn't mind, what was that aha moment where you kind of realized that, you know, other people were having their money work for them?
It was just a random day. I must've been finishing college, or maybe I was already post-college, and it just hit me why my goal shouldn't be to just, you know, work at a job until I have to retire. There's a better way to do this. And that's when I kind of started, you know, I guess the phrase that went through my head was like, you can either work for your money or your money can work for you. But it hit me in a way much stronger than some cliche. It was like, that's a real way to live life.
For sure. Yeah. I think that's so critical to any investing journey, is to just
remember that and work towards it, right? Because, you know, we don't always, not everyone starts out with enough money that you can let it work for you, right? Like you have to build up enough money so that you can let it work for you all the time. But it's a worthwhile journey and philosophy on investing. So, okay, awesome. Well, thanks for a bit of that background. And I'd love to hear, you know, I know you're passionate about the company that you started. Will you tell us a little bit more about why you started and what it does?
Yeah. So just as a background, before I did this, I was working as a mortgage broker in Israel. And so I'm sure most people listening aren't familiar with the Israeli real estate market. The way mortgage brokerage works here is very different than in the States. It's much more of a buyer advocacy type of role where you're hired by the buyers to negotiate with the banks and serve as their liaison to the banks. Another interesting piece of the mortgage play here is you need to have a lot of money to buy a house in Israel or to buy an apartment. And the cost of housing is way out of proportion with income. A couple of years ago, I saw a study that showed different countries, and it was a chart showing him the amount of months of salary, of average salary you need to buy the average home. So places like the US, it was like 2.5 years. And like on the far right side of the chart was Israel, like 12 and a half years of salary to buy an apartment. So that, along with some mortgage restrictions, you can't get more than like 70, 75% LTV. You can't finance closing costs. You need a significant amount of money to buy here. So there were a lot of people, not to mention the underwriting requirements are very strict. So, to make a long story short, I kept running into people who had anywhere from $50,000 to $200,000, and they wanted to buy a place to live, but they couldn't afford it. And they weren't really investment savvy. They would just leave the money in the bank. And the funny thing about money in the bank is that it kind of gets used up over time.
Good point.
So I wanted to create some sort of solution for these people. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it, exploring different options. And I kind of settled in on real estate for the reasons we discussed as a good way for these people to invest. At that point, the question was that most syndications take minimums of 50, 100. I know guys who take 250 as a minimum. And from my experience in the stock market, I knew you got to diversify. I didn't want anyone taking their most of their life savings and putting it all into one deal. So I created this company whereby I didn't know at the time it was called this, but I basically spoke to some lawyers and came up with the fund to funds model, which apparently and then I learned later that it's a thing.
Yeah.
And started creating these LLCs and allowing people to come into deals. At first, we set a $50,000 minimum, and then we moved it down to a $10,000 minimum with the goal of even if someone only has $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, they can already start buying real estate in a diversified way. And if you start young enough with $50,000, that can go a very, very long way.
Absolutely. Yeah. The power of, you know, compounding returns and the types of returns you get in real estate, plus the tax benefits, which might be different for some of your investors. Well, yeah. And I mean, so I think that's a wonderful, amazing, you know, company that you started. I am very curious about a lot of things, but how about we just start with, for the people who are foreign investors that might be listening to this show, if you want to invest in the United States, what in United States real estate syndications, what do you need to do?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The first thing is I need someone in my position, someone in our position, we would need to make sure that we're compliant with the regulations in their country. So in the course of doing this, I've had conversations with lawyers from Australia, lawyers from UK, obviously from Israel and the US. And I feel like I have one other country in there over the years. But basically, every country has its own securities laws, and you want to make sure you're compliant with that. A lot of it boils down to the same types of ideas like you'll see in the US about advertising versus, you know, someone who you know already, et cetera. But the numbers matter, the differences matter. And then most countries have some sort of accredited investor status that resolves a lot of these issues. So that's one component to it. On a practical level, you have to know what's happening. Well, yeah, the taxes are always going to be a little complicated between the US and other places. So if you're buying into real estate in the US, you're placing yourself on or into the US tax authorities, the IRS's radar. So you have to realize that you're going to have to get yourself an ITIN. You're going to have to file taxes in the US. In terms of your cash flow, it's going to be a little bit reduced in the beginning because there's withholding against you. When you get it back when you file, you don't pay more tax, but you do have that withholding. I had some people who do this, and the way they market it as like a fifth distribution. You get four distributions, and then you get the fifth distribution when you file tax. So they package it. The most significant factor to look into, it's a bit of a somber topic, but it's the death tax. Non-US citizens who are investing in the US, the death tax hits at a much lower number. So if you're investing and you're married, you're probably going to want to, again, I'm not going to give tax advice, but talk to someone about that and make sure you structure it in a way that you don't lose a lot of your money to some death tax. That's a very significant issue that needs to be resolved. And then there's a practical consideration that U.S. banks make it very difficult to sign up for an account if you're not not in the U.S. So either to schedule a trip. I've had people schedule trips to the U.S. just to open a bank account in order to get started. They're investing enough money, it made sense for them. But it's to open an account from abroad is complicated. To transfer money into the U.S. is complicated. There are services that make it somewhat doable. I think TransferWise is one of them. That's a famous one that's out there. And with them, you can actually open sort of virtual account and do wires. So it does work. I've had clients who do it, but so that's actually made it easier. But to open an actual account to be able to receive money, it's complicated. So these are all things you're going to want to look into. And it's a lot easier if you have U.S. citizenship.
Yeah. Well, that's a great overview of what it takes. And, what recommendations would you have for someone? Like, would they need to find someone who's just like done it before, or is there some service that they could go to?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
I'm sure there are some people who charge a fortune to do this type of thing.
Yeah.
I've met people who say, yeah, pay me $800 and I'll open a U.S. bank account for you. I'm like, okay, that sounds kind of shady.
Yeah.
But but what happens with KYC? Like, I take care of the KYC. I'm like, okay. But it's a process. Like for things like the ITIN, I know my accountant, I have a U.S. accountant. He's based in Israel and in the U.S. He does this type of thing. He'll help people get it for a couple $100, maybe $150, $200, which it saves a lot of time and energy because if you do it right, it's easy. But if you make mistakes, it's a huge pain in the neck. With everything else, it's really you have to find the people who are knowledgeable. Hopefully you have a good accountant in place already. And you just have to become knowledgeable about it. You know, for maybe for $10,000, $20,000 or small amounts, it's not worth it. But once you're hitting that $100,000 mark, even $50,000, and you're going to build a long-term play around it, it's a heavy lift in the beginning, but it's worthwhile because the potential returns are phenomenal. And so it's a bit of a pain setting it up, but once you have it, you have it. And a lot of the fees you're going to pay are also, they're kind of fixed. So as you scale up, it becomes a smaller and smaller part of your expenses.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that provides a really good overview of what people should, you know, expect the first time around and who it makes sense for. So thanks. So what are you currently, you know, excited about investing in these days?
Good question. I'm kind of suffering from that. I'm actually really excited about retail right now. And so either I'm wrong or I'm ahead of the curve.
Right.
So retail, what we're seeing, I have a partner who's been in retail for 15 years, but what we're seeing in retail right now is with the U.S. coming out of COVID. And I understand there's another surge right now, but even then, just the mentality of people, the severity is not there. We've kind of seen how retail survives COVID. You know, we've seen some properties that have had issues and some problems, but the foreclosures were not what people thought it was going to be. Restaurants came through way ahead of what people thought it was going to be. And now you have an entire country that's just kind of leaving their house for the first time in a year, 2 year and a half. And they don't want to just sit in front of a computer all day ordering things from Amazon. They want to get out there. They want to have experiences. And the retail centers have been adjusting over years to accommodate that with, I'm not even talking just movie theaters. We're talking different types of experience. Of experiential things like escape rooms and one of our retail centers, they have like some sort of like indoor skydiving thing. I don't know exactly what it is, but they're paying their rent. So that's good. And so retail is experiencing a bit of a boom right now. Within the market itself, the cap rates are starting to compress. We're finding it harder and harder to find good deals because cap rates are starting to move down.
Okay.
So I think that's a very interesting space that's kind of been neglected for a long time. I think there's a lot of opportunity there. Multifamily is a great space, but you're buying at a 4 cap. If cap rates start expanding and that goes to a 6, you're going to suffer a lot more than if your retail property goes from a 7 to a 9. So I'm excited about retail. I also acknowledge the fact my investor base is not as excited about retail as I am. So in terms of deals we're looking at now, we are focusing on, we do want our deal flow to be more within the residential world. You know, half of our deals would like to be in the MHP multifamily world. And we're also taking on some industrial partners now as well, which is also a nice space to be in. But yeah, that's kind of where we are right now. I'm most excited about retail, and also MHP, I think, is a great sector that we're just building some good connections in.
Yeah, for sure. And MHP, just for those of you who aren't familiar with all the acronyms, mobile home parks, which we have talked about several times on this show so far. So David, what do you like? I mean, I just want to dive into this whole retail thing because it is an interesting question. I mean, no matter what, we're going to have to figure out what to do with retail, right? Like in the States. And so I know you mentioned some experiential type businesses that, you know, might do well when COVID comes back and that they're paying rent, et cetera. What would you say, there's going to be more of those kinds of experiences happening in retail centers? What do you see as like the balance of retail offerings?
It's not just that. It's even the stores themselves are becoming more of an experience. You go into a store, you go into even a Starbucks or a Panera Breads or all these things. It's not just going in and buying a loaf of bread or a cup of coffee. There's an experience to it. They're making it into an experience, and that's helping them a lot. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is people oftentimes want to go out. They want to see what they're buying. Macy's, this was already a study from a few years ago. Macy's, when online started taking off, they had a plan to start closing stores down. And I forget the first location they shut down, but what they noticed as they shut down stores is their online sales from that area dropped, and they reversed their plans. Amazon just announced they're building they've been building these local little stores for a while. Amazon just announced they're building a department store.
Interesting. That is really odd. Actually, I didn't know that.
what does that tell you about being bearish on retail? I mean, Amazon is going into retail, into brick and mortar.
That is very odd. I'm very curious to see where that goes for sure.
but it's not so odd because people like to get out to see what they're buying, you know, what people kind of expect as part of their life. They go out on a Sunday, they'll go hang out somewhere, they'll get a meal somewhere, they'll go shopping a little bit. It's an experience.
For sure. Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's just an interesting evolution of the trend, and definitely worth looking into for sure.
What I wouldn't buy is a closed mall. Those are areas that they're very expensive to operate. And those are pretty much dead by now, but it's those open strip malls that have a lot of rentable space and not a lot of dead space. That I think there's still a lot of opportunity there.
For sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for going into that more. I mean, I think that you're definitely onto something, and yeah, excited to kind of see where that goes. So also know, David, that you're a technology enthusiast. Will you tell us a little bit about that and, you know, why it's meaningful to you?
Yeah, I've always been into technology. As a kid, I was that kid who was like taking apart and rebuilding computers, you know. It's always been a thing of mine. It's much to my parents' chagrin because the computer wouldn't work half the time. But I happen to be at work in technology as well. And I think it's incredible what you can do with technology. It's my long-term prediction is that technology is going to, I'm not saying this definitively, I'm not putting a timeline on it, but to my mind, technology is the greatest threat to real estate today.
Okay. Tell me more.
So for example, if you could, right now people have to live in urban or suburban centers, right? And you can only build in certain places because of the limitations of what we can build. What if I told you though, that you could build a house wherever you wanted, you'd pay for it brand new at less than 2/3 of the cost of a used house, and you can build it custom to whatever you wanted, and it would be ready to go in 6 weeks.
Yeah, that'd be pretty exciting.
So that's the promise of 3D printed housing. And you put that together with things like either telecommuting like we're doing a lot today, or autonomous vehicles where the commute is not nearly as painful because you don't have to actually be driving. You could be in the backseat getting work done. It opens up whole new areas to build and to people to live. And if all of a sudden you could build a house at 2/3 the price, brand new, what's that going to do to the cost of existing housing?
Yeah, obviously it's going to go down.
Exactly. So that's an interesting, what kind of like futurist, I should say, thought that I have. I don't know when it's going to happen. I'm not saying it is going to happen. I know there's a lot of money invested in real estate, and there's a lot of people with a lot of interest in real estate. But if I have to ask myself a question, which is a kind of thought experiment I like to do from time to time, of what could possibly like destroy the the residential market right now. So that's kind of how I got to this one, thinking like, what could be some sort of black swan event that will just destroy the residential real estate market? So that was one of the directions I went in. The technology could completely upend the entire nature of the market. So that's interesting. So that has me looking. So I'm following stuff on 3D printed housing and it's taking off and there's people doing stuff and it's interesting, but it's not there yet.
For sure. Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, it's, if it's on the way, it will eventually get there. And yes, definitely something to be considered along with, you know, I mean, this is just sort of theoretical, but like our land use in the United States and how we choose to use it, you know? So, I mean, obviously we have a ton of land here compared to a lot of countries, but at the same time, it'll be interesting to see how cities and townships and stuff, you know, what kinds of zoning implications there are for if there is 3D printing on the horizon. But yeah, no, interesting nonetheless. And yeah, cool. Anything else on the technology front you want to mention?
In the prop tech world, there's a lot happening in prop tech right now, but I'm still waiting for some major breakthroughs in there. A lot of the stuff is...
And just for the listeners who aren't familiar with that term, can you just quickly describe it?
Yeah, basically any technology these days is just, you put a couple letters in front of it.
Right.
Property is short for property technology. FinTech is short for financial technology. Right. Agritech is short for agriculture technology. So, you know, just
technology to manage properties.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So they're starting to build property management tools with that. I've seen some technologies that are getting into actual, they'll somehow change the way development is done. But I think aside from 3D printing, I haven't seen a lot of technologies that are going to be transformative just yet. A lot of the stuff is kind of just chipping around the edges, trying to add some level of automation to these processes that people are doing. But I'm curious to see where we go and where we're going to have that, like that breakthrough technology that just kind of changes things in a more significant way.
Yeah, totally. Well, David, you have some awesome stuff going on. Thank you so much for coming on. Will you please share with the listeners how they can learn more about you and your firm and anything else you want to share?
Sure. So I'm active on LinkedIn. It's David Prail, D-O-V-I-D, like David with an O. Last name is P-R-E-I-L. And my website is ydlpinvestments.com. And my podcast, where I talk more about general financial matters, is the thinkwealthypodcast.com. And you can also get it on Apple, Google, et cetera.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I hope you all check out David's podcast and his, you know, connect with him if you want to learn more about what he's up to. Thanks so much for coming on and for sharing so much of your experience and knowledge. And we'll see you next time.
All right. Thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.